What are you going to do with your $250, Ken?
I'm going to hold out for $3.
No, no, it's $250.
What? You're going to Dallas?
You're getting a Social Security cola.
Is it caffeine-free?
It's going to be a lump sum. We're going to give you a lump sum.
I love Chinese food.
President Obama says because we're not getting a cola on our Social Security this year, he thinks we need more money because our health care costs more.
I knew this would happen if McGovern was elected.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, we're not going to talk about cash for codgers anymore. We're going to go directly to the most important issue before the United States Congress today.
The majority leader of the U.S. Senate.
That is correct.
Olympia Snowe.
Exactly. From the state of Maine. She is sort of a Republican, isn't she, Ken?
She's a Republican.
I don't know, because I've been hearing an awful lot of things all this week from an awful lot of conservatives and Republicans about how much they don't like Olympia Snowe.
Well, I've also heard from a lot of Democrats who say that Olympia Snowe has given me cover to vote for the Senate finance bill, health care bill.
I didn't know if Ken Rudin's vote was really in question
on this
particular legislation. But now that Olympia's voted this way, I understand. What kind of Democrats would say that, Ben Nelson?
Blanche Lincoln. Blanche Lincoln, and she's up in 2010.
And then there are also several other Democrats who don't really like this bill that much because, like Jay Rockefeller, the second most senior member of the committee, they think it should have a public option. Maybe they even think it should be single payer. But they surely don't like this particular deal that's been worked out between Max Baucus and, as it turned out, not Chuck Grassley, the guy he tried to play footsie with all these months, but Olympia Snowe.
Which is remarkable because when the Senate Finance Committee voted down the public option a few weeks ago, both Jay Rockefeller and Chuck Schumer said, not to worry, it's coming back. And then suddenly, lo and behold, we have Olympia Snowe saying, sure, I'll vote for it. I'll give Barack Obama the bipartisan cover that he so desperately wanted, but only without the public option. And Max Baucus says, fine. And so the committee goes out and votes 14-9 in favor of it.
Including Jay Rockefeller.
Every Democrat.
We assume that he will do so on the floor. They'll attempt on the floor to reintroduce the public option. It will fail, I assume, on the floor with a few Democrats joining all the Republicans.
And if it passes, you lose Olympia Snowe, and then there goes the bipartisanship.
I just don't think it's going to pass. I don't think that the public option will be re-added in the Senate. However, I do expect it to be in the bill the House votes on probably in early November.
The front page headlines say, you know, and President Obama said that this is a great step forward for a health care overhaul, and that's true, but there are still two completely different health care bills in the Senate, three different bills in the House. Matter of fact, of the five bills, only the Finance Committee one got one Republican vote, Olympia Snowe, and that's the one everybody's focusing on.
And it's also the one that's probably going to drive the eventual compromise, not just because of Olympia Snowe, but she symbolizes the fact that it is the closest to being in some sense or another bipartisan. And while it might not get any Republican votes, it needs to be at least bipartisan in the sense of including both halves of the Democratic Party.
Right.
In the House, that means the Blue Dogs. In the Senate, it means some of those people we've already talked about. And that's the ticket to getting some kind of a bill. And in the end, that's all really I think the White House wants.
And Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe's cohort from Maine, also indicated this week that there was a possibility she could vote for that bill as well.
Now, to some degree, she's providing a little support for her colleague. Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins
There's a little rivalry. Yeah, sure.
Yes, but at the same time, I think they have also had each other's back when it came to election time and to moments of high stress and high visibility. And certainly this is such a moment for Olympia Snowe.
One thing that's different, a lot of people have compared Olympia Snowe's heresy to Arlen Specter. There's two different things here. First of all, the Republican Party in Pennsylvania is far more socially conservative than the Republican Party in Maine.
It's hard to believe, but true. No, the Pennsylvania Republican Party is more conservative.
Certainly on abortion, on
social issues.
Roman Catholic population there. But in Maine, Olympia Snowe really is the kind of Republican Party, the Bill Cohn, the Margaret Chase Smith, the Susan Collins, that Republicans have been electing in the past. John McKernan, who's Olympia Snowe's husband, former governor. Everybody's talking about, will there be a revolt by conservatives against Olympia Snowe?
Not in Maine.
Of course, she's not up until 2012, but I suspect you're right, that there will be no revolt, unlike like what happened to Arlen Specter, who was forced to leave the Republican Party because he was going to get booted out in the primary.
So out of step with the conservatives, who are more dominant in Pennsylvania.
Right.
President Obama had, in a sense, a victory here because his bill keeps moving. Still a lot of hurdles, of course, for this particular bill to get over. Majority Leader Harry Reid is meeting with a small band of desperate Democrats to try to put something together between the two bills in the Senate. And then over on the House side, Nancy Pelosi trying to put together those three bills so they can go to a floor vote next month. Meanwhile, the president, having been given a little bit of a breather on health care, takes a trip to New Orleans to talk about how are things going for those Katrina victims down there. That trip that Obama is making down to New Orleans, by the way, is not without controversy in and of itself.
Two controversies. One, that he only spent like 5 minutes before he heads off to San Francisco
for
a fundraiser.
0 minutes for Mississippi.
And
right?
Nothing for Mississippi, too, which is, of course, you know, Republicans, like people who are loyal to Haley Barbour and Thad Cochran. And
people are mentioning Haley Barbour as a possible national candidate.
Yeah, well, anyway, the point is people are thinking that he's giving short shrift.
All right, so the president goes to Louisiana. He doesn't go to Mississippi. He does go to Texas. He makes what I would call an extraordinary outreach gesture to College Station, Texas, home of Texas A&M, very conservative territory, making a speech there on this particular trip. And by the way, speaking of the president, Ken, I want to congratulate you on winning the Nobel Prize for Humor.
Actually, I was in Phoenix. It was not humor.
I understand.
It's a great joke, but I understand.
You were in Arizona at the time.
Visiting KJAZZ, K-J-Z-Z. But while I was in Arizona, I was awoken early one morning to hear that President Obama, I think it was from The Onion or something like that.
You thought it was a call from
I
The
did.
Onion.
That President Obama won the Nobel Prize?
Well, I think the Nobel Committee was thinking that in giving the Peace Prize to President Obama, they were actually challenging him to make a decision for peace in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And it was like a challenge to him to be a man of peace.
Well, yes, but I think he really got it for getting Sergeant Crowley and Henry Louis Gates together. That, the beer summit, is to me what was really what it was. Look, I've never seen a Nobel Peace Prize awarded on the basis of hope or anticipation rather than accomplishment. President Obama is the first one who said, I'm not deserving of this award. And while there was
I don't deserve to stand with those who have won it in the past.
Right,
but I'm not going to turn it down because I don't want to dishonor the spirit in which it was given.
And I think John McCain, speaking of Arizona, John McCain, I think, said it perfectly. He said, look, we should be proud that it's an American president who was awarded, but there's a tremendous burden on him now to get things accomplished because a lot of things have not been successfully accomplished in the 10 months he's been president, with Afghanistan, with the Mideast, with Jay Rockefeller and Max Baucus. They don't even get along. So until they get along, I don't think that he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize.
No, I think that's a good test. Yeah. It's a good test of whether or not he really should keep it or give it back at some later date. But really what people want to know from the president is, what are you going to do about Afghanistan? One person who thinks he knows what the president ought to do about Afghanistan is his vice president, Joe Biden, who's all over the news, including on the cover of Newsweek, basically giving his advice that it's time to change the mission and ratchet down our commitment.
And Joe Biden was originally one of the big supporters of a surge into Afghanistan. He, along with President Obama or candidate Barack Obama, during the 2008 presidential election, talked about, well, Iraq may be the bad war, but Afghanistan is the good war.
That's where we should have kept our attention.
Exactly. But I think he has made several trips to Afghanistan and has come back with the understanding that this is not where we should be spending our money and our manpower, that the real focus should be Pakistan.
Because he doesn't think that the government in Afghanistan is really a credible partner, or because he thinks that, for whatever reason, the mission that he and candidate Obama foresaw in 2007, 2008, is not a mission that we can carry out today. Do you buy all that?
Well,
or is this basically two guys who ran against Hillary Clinton, the relatively hawkish Democratic candidate for president, wanted to be against Iraq, but wanted to be in favor of some kind of strong reaction to terrorism. So they picked on Afghanistan, and now they're backing off it because they can see it's going to cost them.
Well, it's going to cost them politically, and that's exactly right. First of all, by most accounts, U.S. effort in Afghanistan is not succeeding.
Oh, even by McChrystal's account,
right.
We're basically getting thrown out of the country.
And they're completely ignoring McChrystal's suggestion that 45,000 more troops should be sent to Afghanistan. For what purpose? Plus the fact that the Democratic left is getting very restless. They thought, well, you know, we can talk nice things about sending troops to Afghanistan if it'll get us out of Iraq. But now that Obama is in the White House, Afghanistan doesn't look as rosy as it did. Corrupt government, we're not making any headway against the Taliban, and perhaps the Taliban is not the enemy here, at least the enemy for United States purposes.
Maybe they're not synonymous with al-Qaeda.
But if it is, and if the Taliban has free reign in Afghanistan and it helps topple the Pakistani government, president, then you know what the commercials are going to look like in 2010. Who lost Korea, as Republicans said about Harry Truman in 1952? Who lost Afghanistan? And it would be Biden and Obama.
All right. But right now, Biden's playing as this guy who's got this contrary advice, who's coming in with this really different point of view in the White House, supposedly a lonely voice, not so lonely anymore as more people close to the president come around to the view of Afghanistan that you were just describing. Is it really that he is the contrary opinion within the White House, or are we hearing all this from Joe Biden as a kind of mouthpiece, really, for the real way the White House feels? A kind of trial balloon, really.
Well, that's a fair question. We don't know that, actually, because we have not heard any pronouncements one way or the other from President Obama. And I think one of the reasons McChrystal and the other generals are just sitting back is because they don't know which way the administration is even leaning. I mean, back in March, of course, Obama said that more troops are needed and we'll have more troops. And now they seem to have backed off that. But at the same time, there's no talk about, you listen to Robert Gibbs during the press briefings, there's no talk about withdrawal of troops. There's no talk about cutbacks. It's almost like a wait-and-see attitude.
Or just a refusal to add any more troops.
And you're talking about Biden's position that seems completely different than Hillary Clinton, who apparently, reportedly, is one of those people who say that we do need more troops.
Yeah, and she is, what is she doing?
She is Secretary of State.
Which would seem to be the person who was the closest, in some respects, advisor to the president on such matters. But more of this later. You mentioned 2010 a moment ago. I know 2010 is coming close to being only a year away, the elections of November 2010.
Wait, that makes this year 2009.
By my calculations. Right. And we're already getting some changes in Congress well in advance of that election. We're already seeing some people moving around.
Well, the news this week is Robert Wexler, a liberal Democratic congressman from Palm Beach County in Florida, Boca Raton area, solidly Democratic district, overwhelmingly Democratic district. Robert Wexler announced this week that he's leaving Congress as of January to be the head of this Mideast peace effort. Wexler is one of the more forceful and vehement supporters of Israel in Congress. And some people wonder whether there's some differences he has with the Obama administration, who doesn't see Israel the same way that Robert Wexler does. So anyway, Wexler is leaving Congress, and there will be a new special election in January.
Is that a seat the Democrats can hold?
They will hold. It's a solidly Democratic seat. Republicans don't have any chance of winning it. But more alarming to the Republican Party is not so much that they won't win Florida 19, but they could very well lose New York 23.
This is very hard to believe now, because we are talking about John McHugh's district, the man who's become the new Secretary of Army. And so he left Congress, and now the seat is open. They're having a special election. Has there ever been a Democrat in this district?
Never. And that's what's so fascinating. The election, of course, is November 3rd. It's a special election to replace McHugh. You have Didi Scozzafava, who is a longtime state assemblywoman, Republican, who is liberal on many issues. She's pro-choice. She's pro-gay rights.
She's an old-fashioned centrist Northeastern Republican.
Right.
Of whom there are how many now in Congress? In the House, zero, right?
Zero I mean, in the Northeast, and there's only two Republicans in New York State out of 29 districts. So
it's so hard to imagine.
It is remarkable.
I cannot believe those numbers. And you're basically saying that they're not going to get this one.
And they're not going to keep that because Scozzafava is too liberal for some conservatives, and the Conservative Party has put up Doug Hoffman, first-time candidate who tried to get the Republican nomination. Doug Hoffman, endorsed by Club for Growth, endorsed by Gary Bauer, who is a big force in upstate New York.
Well, probably not. But he is among the people who will be turning
the
out
movement
for
conservatives.
This special election.
And a new poll this week by Siena College shows the Democrat Bill Owens, first-time candidate, with a lead over the Republican and the conservative candidate. Hoffman, the conservative, has 23% in a three-way race. The split among the Republicans and conservatives may elect a Democrat for the first time in that district's history.
All right, so we've been seeing this phenomenon in a few places. We've seen it particularly in the northeastern United States, where the remaining Republican strength is largely on the very conservative side, including on social issues. And so when they put up a more centrist candidate who might defeat the Democrat under more normal circumstances, that person gets undercut by a third party candidate. And
true
is
believers.
That not the story we're seeing in New Jersey?
Well, in New Jersey, it's true that a third party candidate is hurting the Republican Party. Chris Christie, the former U.S. attorney, had a huge lead over John Corzine, the Democratic governor of New Jersey, widely unpopular. Matter of fact, his disapproval numbers as of this week is 56%, which is his best showing in months. But there's a third party
rally.
But there's a third an independent candidate by the name of Chris Daggett, who's coming from the left. He's a former Republican Tom Kaine aide, but he's a pro-environment. He's more the liberal wing of the party. But he's really the kind of campaign, the vitriol between Corzine and Christie is getting so ugly that Daggett is gaining in the polls, too.
All right, but now is
he... A lot of these votes are coming away from Chris Christie.
All right, because Christie is the guy who's out there campaigning saying, Daggett and Corzine are one and the same, or I'm running against both of them. So, well, in other words, he is concerned about losing some of the anti-Corzine vote.
Do you remember the Nixon slogan in 68? A vote for Wallace is a vote for Humphrey, because it's splitting the opposition.
But the prospects are brighter for Republicans in this off-year gubernatorial election in Virginia.
Much better.
Where you've got a simpler situation, got kind of a classic Democratic nominee in Creed Eads. You've got kind of a classic Republican in Bob McDonnell. And he's got a pretty good lead in a state that, while it went for Barack Obama and has had kind of a strong Democratic trend in recent years, is still fully capable of electing the more conservative of two candidates.
We're seeing almost like a typical Virginia election in that, since going back to 1977, whenever you have a Democrat in the White House, you have a Republican elected governor of Virginia the following year, and vice versa. You have Barack Obama in the White House, so McDonnell has the lead. But what's interesting is that Creed Eads seemed to latch on to a seemingly winning issue several weeks ago, if not months ago, on this thesis.
But it was a 20-some-year-old thesis.
It was 1989.
That McDonnell had written when he was at Regent University.
And while I'm not dismissing the potency of that argument for turning off female voters, Creed Eads has had nothing else to say other than that for weeks.
Because that was the only thing that moved the polls in his direction. So obviously his advisors were saying, keep going, keep pushing that thesis, because that's all you've got. Apart from that, you're just going to get clobbered.
And whether it's fair to make this a referendum on Barack Obama's presidency or not, I suspect it's not fair, but people will try to make the connection. The White House seems to be floundering here in this race because they had the demographics. They had two very popular governors, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, that Creed Eads was hoping to succeed. And yet he didn't run on their record. He seemed to be running against Bob McDonnell. And I think it's turned off a lot of Democratic voters.
You know, but on the other hand, when you speak of the demographics, the kind of demographics that worked for Kaine and worked for Warner and worked for Obama don't seem to be working for Eads, because he is not from Northern Virginia. He doesn't really have a strong appeal in Northern Virginia. And you cannot expect the same sort of turnout among African-Americans and under 30 voters in this Virginia election. It's going to be a relatively weak turnout, not necessarily for a Virginia gubernatorial race, but for a statewide contest in terms of these last several that the Democrats have been winning.
And when Creed Eads won the Democratic primary back in June by an overwhelming majority, he had over a majority of the vote, you think, well, this is, you know, real momentum for Creed Eads. As it turned out, it probably was a rejection more of Terry McAuliffe, who lost the primary, than anything else.
He was seen as a carpetbagger, even though he obviously had been living in Virginia for a number of years, but he's seen as a guy who came there basically with the Clinton presidency, and he just was trying to glom onto a good opportunity to run for governor.
And so while a Republican victory in Virginia would be according to what we've seen in the past because of historical trends, if the Republicans win Virginia and New Jersey, some people could say, justifiably or not, that the Republicans are on a roll. I think 1969 was the last time that Republicans took away the governorships of Virginia and New Jersey from the Democrats. If they do it again, people will say something is wrong with the Democratic Party.
People are already saying it in anticipation of a double Republican win, and then we'll get into the debate about what exactly indications it may give for 2010.
But ultimately, for all the interpretations we're going to make the day after the election, New York 23 may have nothing to do with what's going on in Virginia, which may have nothing to do with New Jersey, which may have nothing to do with 2010 or 2012, for that matter.
And none of that has anything to do with this week's political podcast. And that's it.
But Ron, you also realize you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
Really? I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Woke up election day, skies, gunpowder, and shades of gray. Beneath the dirty sun, whistle my time away. Then just about sundown, you come walking through town. Your booty is clicking like the barrel of a pistol spinning around. Don't worry, darling, but baby, don't you fret. We're living in the future, and none of this has happened yet.
This is actually funny.
It's very funny.
But I don't know what we're talking about.